with the PS4 controller when it was down in Long Beach. But at the Web Summit, you could see these applications, yes, using AI, but kind of using intelligent control technologies happening. I was at a side party, a VR side party at Web Summit, where essentially, so it was VR, as people know, is kind of like the whole Meta Quest 3 thing, whatever. And traditionally, it was used mostly for gaming, because you need to create a virtual environment first, and then you need to plug yourself into it. It's kind of a very capital-intensive, mm-hmm. time-consuming process. And a local VC, a guy called Tipitat, he was demonstrating a new technology that one of his companies is doing right now. And he's basically using the 3D cameras on the consumer virtual reality headsets, not even like the professional ones, just the consumer ones. And these would be like $400 US kind of headsets. And what happens is that he can use the cameras to scan the virtual environment, mm-hmm. and it would be modeled into a virtual space, and you can do cross reality things with it. And suddenly, there are really, really interesting industrial and business and productivity applications. So, for example, like in construction, one thing that's always an issue with using robotics in construction is that you would have to program the robot for every single conceivable situation. But if you can use VR headsets for remote controlled robots and just scan them every morning as the construction environment changes, that's very interesting. Right. In a restaurant or hospitality environment, you know, you left the milk out, or, you know, you moved the coffee mug or whatever. But if you can just scan that as the situation changes, you can have real-time updates. And so these things, suddenly there are really interesting applications. So that's one thing. The other thing that I thought was really, really cool is kind of there are sort of more useful, more realistic applications of virtual reality now. Not just around virtual reality, but also AI. So I tried on a pair of gloves. The industry-leading edge is called Manus gloves. They're basically sensor capture, sort of motion capture gloves. And I didn't expect very much, but they captured the movements of my fingers, my joints, yeah. exactly. And you know, for gaming, it doesn't really matter. But for industrial applications, as to move robots, to do stuff like that, it's going to be big. So I think robotics revolution is coming to us maybe as early as 2 or 3 years, maybe 5 or 10. I do not think the current model, the current rush toward pure humanoid robots with the walking and stuff like that is going to be the most efficient way to go. The robots are controlled, which had, you know, extendable legs, but also wheels that can move around a little bit more efficient. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The second thing I want to talk about is this is really interesting, that kind of just happened over the weekend. I went to a award conference for this group called Peer-to-Peer Tutoring. It was out in Surrey. And I went to their kind of award conference for the academic year. Yeah. And they kind of do peer-to-peer tutoring, essentially, among high schoolers. And, you know, these things are always a little bit self-congratulatory. But I thought it's interesting that as the technology advances for AI and stuff like that, it doesn't necessarily take away the impetus for having strong training and sort of strong education, but maybe the format changes. Maybe it can be more interactive. Maybe it can be a little bit more peer-to-peer. I certainly think these kids were doing really good work. So there are lots of stuff, interesting stuff happening. By the way, when I was down in California, I also got a sunburn. Always a great thing. So there you go.
Excellent. So, yeah, so robots.
I really think this is kind of the thing that's underlooked every time you go to these things, because the media coverage is always about AI, artificial intelligence. And you're like, and one of the best things I saw, one of the best memes I saw on social media was, we thought we would have all this technology so we don't have to like mow the grass or, you know, like flip the burgers or do any of these menial tasks. But instead, you know, the AI is like replacing us in thinking tasks. Like, what's the point? And mm-hmm. I think that critique has a lot going for it, because I think actually if you look at where AI has been going in terms of replacing knowledge work, it's not been very, very good for the most part.
Right.
But if you look at a lot of the menial tasks, which require embodied AI. Embodied AI is another way of saying robotics.
Yeah.
we're not quite there yet, but it's very achievable. Go ahead.
What about farm work? Because underpaid farm work. I mean, I think like picking apples. I mean, can it pick blueberries and raspberries and other things? I think this is never really brought up. But how do you think for some basic farm work? How is this coming along?
So farm work is a little bit like construction in the sense that one conceptual thing you have to realize in robotics is that a robot has an environment. So like a self-driving car, for example, the environment is the entire world in which it drives around.
Yeah.
Like a factory robot has a very fixed environment because the factory is pre-organized, it's very clear. So a construction site or a farm environment is somewhere in the middle. It's a fixed environment, but there are things that move around a little bit.
Right.
And so I think actually farm work, robotics is very, very achievable. I think we actually do have the technology already, but what professional engineers call integration hell, so like putting the whole thing together, is kind of the difficult part right now. What I mean by that is when you have a human pick an apple or a bunch of grapes or walnuts or whatever, it's going to pick it with his hands or some kind of a tool, right? But when a robot picks any kind of usable robot for picking fruits and vegetables and nuts and stuff like that, is not going to use the classics of hand-picking motion. What I mean by that is that it's probably going to use a vacuum. So a vacuum tube that goes to like the apple, sucks the apple, drops the apple in like a basket. That's much better. That's much, much more efficient for a machine to do, much faster, repeatable than using some kind of mechanical extendable hand to pick up the apple. Because using a mechanical hand to pick up the apple, one thing they haven't quite figured out is soft versus hard textures. But with a vacuum, you can just adjust the negative air pressure.
I never thought about a vacuum like. That would kind of work with the blueberries and the raspberries. Now, have people devised systems with the idea of the suction concept?
The suction concept is usually used for soft subjects or flexible subjects. But there are very, very easy ways to get around even small objects. Like if you have a really small walnut, you can still use a suction cup. You can just put a web, like a grill, on the face of the suction cup, right? And then we just stay there until you drop it. And it's flexible, it's very manipulable. So what I'm trying to say is not so much suction cup is the future, it's more like
the
tools you use, how you use it, how you organize the workflow will not be a one-to-one replication of how humans do it. And this actually brings me to a conversation I almost forgot. I meant to follow up on and probably will do an interview on. I spoke with a guy called Steve Feiner, who is actually like a full-on professor of computer science at Columbia University, and he was actually one of the like gold-plated speakers at the AWE conference. And I spoke to him over like a drinks party I sneaked into. I wasn't officially invited.
We got about 30 seconds.
And he was like, look, in the future, when you have like a warehouse robot, it's not necessarily like one guy moves one thing with one robot. It's going to be like maybe one guy controls four robots or 100 robots, or maybe they self-assemble. These things remain to be worked out, but the technology, I think, is there.
Excellent. Thanks, Stephen.
No worries. A pleasure.
And now it's time for Gardening with Embark. And then right after Gardening Embark, we're going to be back with Peter to talk about the bricks.
Maybe future robotic gardening.
All right. Welcome to Gardening with Embark. Joining me here in the studio is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our resident gardening expert.
Hi, good morning.
So, good morning. So we've spent the last couple of weeks, we're sort of in the middle, getting to the middle of the season, and we already have some of the crops we put in the ground coming up.
Correct. Yeah.
And we're harvesting them, and we're also have some other plants that are sort of coming up that we'll be producing later in the summer that we need to think about. So we're busy with everything that's going on.
Yes. But, as you mentioned, the garden is very busy at the moment with lots of crops, garden beds full of vegetables. Harvesting, maintaining, watering.
But even with all that going on, we still need to be thinking ahead. We can't get caught up in the moment.
Correct. Correct. So here at Embark, we encourage to all our gardeners to garden year-round. So just don't focus on spring and summer, but let's go over the winter too. So at the moment, it's just the right time to start thinking what I would like to grow in the fall. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned, we are just so busy harvesting time, pinching, keeping the garden wet, watered and weeded and mulched and all that. But just stop a little while and think why I would like to grow over the fall. So at the moment we have a good weather, so the soil is warm, lots of long days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the time to select a section in the garden that is not full sun, but is in the shade or half shade. And that will be where we start our nursery. And particularly if we would like to have Brussels sprouts for Christmas, for winter break, now is the time to start our nursery where we come and start all Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, overwintering cabbage, and as well the Walla Walla onions if we want to start from seeds. So this is now is the right time to start because the Walla Walla onions is a very nice vegetable that overwinters very nice. So we can keep it growing over the winter. So now, but they are very slow. They are very slow seeds. So we need to start right in these weeks, these 2 weeks that we have. Yeah. So we can have a nice little seedlings by September to transplant when we harvest all our summer crops.
Excellent. So you mentioned about the plot should be sort of part sun, part shade. Why is that important?
Because it's important because we don't want to having to water constantly. So we want that the seedlings don't get too much sun when they are so young. Mm-hmm. So we just want them to get this good weather, but not to overexpose to the sun. And that as well, because when nurseries already need to be frequently watered, but if we put them in the direct sun, we will almost watering every day. So we don't want to do that. Yeah. So keep the soil moist, but in a nice shady area. At the moment, even it's good because at the moment as well, we have to identify which area for our garden site has this kind of environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. So here, for instance, in the learning garden, we have a garden bed underneath a tree. Mm-hmm. So this is our preferred area. So the sunlight just filters to the leaves or the tree and reach to the garden bed. And that garden bed is always moist. We don't have to worry about that. Oh, I forgot to water. And when we realize, our plants are all suffering in stress. Yeah. So it's nice, keeps the soil moist. Not much light, but again, it's nice and warm, and the plants are just happy.
So it sounds like, we're sort of going back to planting gardens, because often, people are focusing on things like tomatoes, which want lots and lots and lots of sun. But when you're planting your garden, putting your boxes out, it might be a good idea to sort of have some. Maybe you got one over in a different part of your garden or area that is like this with some shade.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So, in our garden here, we have some boxes that are directly full sun, so every day get the sun, and the others are underneath trees, so they are in the shade. So those are our favorite boxes to start a nursery.
Right. So with these fall and winter plants, are we mainly talking starting from seeds here?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So we start from seeds, Walla Walla onions, the Brussels sprouts, we can have cabbages, overwinter cabbages, broccoli, sprouting broccolinis, they are the main crops that we would like for the fall. Now, we should remember that the vegetables that do very well in the fall are the same vegetables that do very well in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
However, when we are starting the spring, the temperature goes from cold to hot.
Yeah, right.
On fall is the opposite. It goes from hot to cold, but the same type of vegetables. So if the vegetables can stand cold weather, they will stand the cold weather at the end of the season or the fall. So so peas very much starting in September. So by October, they are just in the right weather that they like it. But starting right now is for all those vegetables that take at least 8 weeks to germinate and turn into a nice seedling.
So that's quite a long time, 8 weeks. So we're gonna be putting things in the ground now, and tending that ground with regular watering and stuff. But it's gonna be a little while before we start seeing shoots coming up.
Yes. So at the moment we will put the seeds and they germinate in 1 week. They should be up And then we had to take care, because at the moment, you know that there is slugs around, which love seedlings.
Yes.
We have aphids around that as well like seedlings. So, yeah, so we have to take care of those little seedlings. And I overseed. So just counting that some of them are going to be eaten by the slugs.
Right. So are you out there every day looking for issues? Or, how attentive do we need to be to these shoots?
Well, every time that we watch the garden, we get in contact with our plants. I advise to do hand watering. So water with a watering wand, and you go and at the time touch new plants. If you are watering the soil, you will be removing, keeping your leaves around, collecting the plant, hiking the plant while you water around the soil. Right. So that's the way that we get in contact with the plants, and we can see, oh, there is aphids, there are ants, and why there are so many ants. And it's beautiful to see when there is a ladybug around.
Mm-hmm.
And slugs, usually they show up around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you gardening has troubles with the slugs, just show around 5 o'clock, and then you will find them just coming out from their hiding, ready to start munching on the vegetables. There is two options. You pick them and dispose them in the composter or somewhere else, or you just find a way to get rid of the slugs. With aphids, very much I look for ants. Mm-hmm. When ants go up and down a plant, means that there are aphids, and I just follow the ants and they direct me where the aphids are. At the moment, we have two types that I have shown. We have the black ones, the black aphids, and the green aphids. They are the two ones I have seen in our gardens. And I keep an eye on the population. So if there is one plant that is sick, that's all right. And the nearby plants are all okay. They are not affected, so that's okay. And if it's a small population, I still use my hands to squish the aphids into the underneath the leaves. It's a squish. I avoid doing jet spraying on the leaves. The leaves get damaged. So I avoid that because the leaves are the food factory of a plant. They through photosynthesis, they create sugars. So why to damage that? So I just prefer to squish them, So aphids, and if they're ladybugs, awesome. Now at the moment, ladybugs are laying eggs.
Yeah,
which they turn into a small caterpillar, they will say, and that caterpillar will turn into another insect, look like a little crocodile, and then we turn into a ladybug. So we have to be very careful that we don't destroy the middle stage of the ladybug from egg to adult. So we have to be very careful that not by accident we just say, oh, this is an insect, and you squish it.
Because they're your friends.
They're our friends, indeed. Yeah.
So we're putting in seeds in the ground now. How long before we get towards the harvest?
Okay, so we put the seeds right now. So we have 1 week, they germinate. And from there, we count 7 more weeks, so which sends us almost at the beginning of September.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the seedlings will be ready to transplant to their final stage, and from there the transplanted we again count another 10 weeks.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so we're putting in that germinating, getting them to a strong point, and then at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, we're going to move them over to some of the places that our summer crops are finishing up.
Correct. So by the end of September, for instance, I tend to remove all my tomato plants.
Yeah,
because there is no point to keep them longer. They should have been produced by then. All the tomatoes should have been, the green, red tomatoes being harvested. The green tomatoes can be harvested and mature indoors. So that space now becomes free and ready for welcoming new crops, the fall crops.
Excellent. Well, it's week 25, and that's these timelines that we're talking about here, and getting things done at the right time is why we're tracking it by these week numbers, because you need to be on time. So this sounds really exciting for people who maybe focus on the summer as the obvious growing season, but you can really get things going and get some wonderful, wonderful harvests coming in the fall.
That's right. So we work by weeks. I'm sorry. As keep track of what's happening. So week 25, we start in the week 25. This weekend is the summer solstice, which is great. After that, we have to think, oh, the days are getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
And then we have week 26. That is the, we must start our nursery by that time. So we have 2 weeks to play, to think what I'm going to plant, what I get my seeds, find a spot where I want to plant, prepare it. And then by week 26, by the end of week 26, we have started our nursery. And then we have the 10 weeks of school holidays, elementary, secondary school. So 10 weeks of holidays, 10 weeks for us to grow our nursery. When we return in September, the first, second week, we'll say, okay, which plants have ended producing? And we can start our fall gardening in September. So, yeah, so it's very, very quick going. And then by September as well, we will start thinking, by week 36, we will start thinking on winterizing our garden.
Right.
But we had to know that by week 41, we will have the first frost. So it's, once we get September, things cool off very fast.
Yeah.
We don't want to get caught like, oh, I forgot to buy the plastic, I forgot to build my hoop house and all that.
Well, excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo. Everyone should be, if you want your fall crops, and you got some time, a little window right now to get things started, and you're going to have some plants ready to transfer in the fall and some nice harvests. Thanks so much for explaining all that to us today.
Well, happy to share our experiences here from the garden.
Thank you, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. How do people find out more about Embark?
Embark is located in the Student Union building in the ground floor. You can find us as and our work at embarksustainability.org or through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Great. And you're listening.
See you next week.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CGSF 90.1 FM. Democracy Now! Will be up in about 8 minutes. But first, we're going to talk about the BRICS.
The BRICS. And we got Stephen to help me out.
And so the BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India,
China, and South Africa.
China and South Africa.
And actually, it was originally BRIC. South Africa came a bit later.
Right. And it was sort of established as something of a counterpoint to the G7.
I think it was suggested as by an economist. It wasn't even a formulaic thing. Right. And then it kind of snowballed from there to now it is an official organization.
It was like originally a meme coined by a Goldman Sachs banker to describe what he saw as the future. It was insane. It was hilarious. But yeah, now it's just like an official thing. So memes can turn into real life.
but they have meetings, annual meetings, and so on. I'm going to read from Wikipedia, and Stephen Fan here will maybe fill in on this. This is under the BRICS payment system. At the 2015 BRICS summit in Russia, ministers from the BRICS states initiated for a payment system that would be an alternative to the SWIFT system. And I'm going to skip ahead a bit here. China also launched its alternative to SWIFT, the cross-border interbank payment system, which enables financial institutions worldwide to send and receive information about financial transactions. Now, tell me your take on this. I mean, they're trying to do an alternative to SWIFT, Stephen.
Yeah, so I don't think it works, and not necessarily for the typical reasons.
Maybe you can just quickly explain what SWIFT is.
Yeah, so SWIFT is really the global interbank payment system. So let's say, you know, you are a buddy of mine who lives in the UK or Portugal, and I want to pay you. And the way the payment is actually done is not I pay you money, is that my bank, let's say it's Royal Bank of Canada, they withdraw a certain amount of money from my account, like on my behalf. And then the bank pays his bank, the correspondent bank in Portugal or the UK, and the money gets settled between the banks at the end of the day, right? So, typically there will be thousands of transactions going one way and then other thousands of transactions going the other. And so maybe they don't need to, like, keep paying us each other back and forth. They just kind of settle the difference at the end of the day.
Okay.
So that's a simpler version. And then so that makes the global payment system run on the bank and to some extent on a central bank level.
So why can't the BRICS counter it? In fact, here it seems that mainland China has their own alternative, India and Russia, and also Brazil has PICS, Russia has SPFS, and India has structured financial message system. So why don't you think they can do an alternative to SWIFT?
So any alternative to SWIFT that is sanctions proof, I got to watch the time, is very, very difficult to implement, about at least orders of magnitude harder to implement than SWIFT itself. And the reason has nothing to do with the payment system. The reason has to do with the underlying currency. Because something like 90% of the global SWIFT payments are really conducted in dollars, U.S. dollars, which are issued and to some extent managed and controlled by the U.S. government. So if you are a bank in Iraq or in Qatar or any of these places that deals in U.S. dollar transactions, and everyone must deal with in U.S. dollar transactions to some degree, the U.S. government can cut you off at any minute of any day by designating you as a non-compliant organization, you can no longer receive or send out dollars. So the problem with SWIFT is that they can either do an alternative to SWIFT that conducts the same transactions in dollars, which means they're no longer sanctions proof because the US can just cut off the supply of dollars. You know, the payment system doesn't really matter. The payment system is trivial. Or what they really are trying to do in the case of China, for example, is they would do a deal with Iran or Colombia or any of these countries that does not involve the use of dollars, that involves the use of their own bilateral currencies. So, for example, China would do a deal with Iran where it exports so much machinery to Iran, and then they would pay in, settle in RMB, like the yuan, or in Iranian currency or whatever, and then Iranian would export so much oil to China. And of course, when you break it down like that, this is essentially a barter system. And barter systems are just bad in general. This is why currency was invented in the first place, because barter doesn't work, it doesn't generalize, it doesn't let you essentially abstract away the complexities of bartering into something a lot neater, like in currency. What they really need is a third-party currency. But unfortunately for them right now, as of this moment, the third-party currency for global international transactions is the U.S. dollar. So that doesn't, like, it doesn't matter what it's the BRICS system or whatever system, it doesn't get them around the dollar problem. So that's the problem with U.S. dollar hegemonic status as the global reserve currency, the global currency of transactions for these countries. Of course, it also has a certain problem for the United States, but that's a different problem.
Well, the thing is, I think if the United States, it was under Donald Trump, keeps they said, oh, Donald Trump in January of this year said, oh, if they go to BRICS having their own currency, then I'm going to do 100% tariffs. But if he's doing terrible tariffs anyway, I think that the BRICS are going to succeed in the future. I'll tell you why, because I think that it's like, what have you got to lose?
Yeah, now? Listen,
because
they're
already doing bad stuff.
We've got 1 minute left, so I want to insert something here, which is that the thing with the dollar dominance is that right now, so far, it seems like it's a big gain for the big oops for the United States, and it's bad for other countries like China or whatever. But that's not the case. Having your own currency be the reserve currency creates in economics what is known as a Triffin dilemma. Triffin is a Belgian-American economist. And the dilemma is this. In order to supply the rest of the world with sufficient usable reserves of U.S. dollars to use for international savings, investment decisions, and transactions, the United States must, and that means must, run a current account deficit, like a trade deficit, in order to finance sufficient outflows of dollars, right? Because there needs to be X amount of dollars every year outside the United States to do all these things. So where do these dollars come from? It comes from the United States, and it comes from the United States specifically running a trade deficit so that it buys more with its dollars than it sells in dollars. So the dollar stays abroad. And so if you have a long-term structure...
So we're Trump can't make up his mind. Week. Trump can't make up his mind. He said, we have a trade deficit, and he still wants the United States dollar to be the reserve currency.
So. And this is why dollar dominance is bad for American manufacturing, because the trade deficit pushes up the currency value too high. It's bad for American export.
All right. Thanks for listening today. This has been Speak Up. Democracy Now! Is coming up right now.